And there's a specific elliptic curve over a small finite field and a base point and private key. And you have to compute the public key. You have to decode a certain message, or decrypt a certain message. And in part C, you have to encrypt a certain message. So part C has two parts of sort of things you have to do. One is you have to find a point on the curve whose x-coordinate is the day of the month in which you were born. And the other part is to encrypt the resulting point. Okay. Problems 6, 7, and 8 involve things we've done in class involving modular forms. So part 6 involves computing the matrix of a Heck operator on a space of modular forms. I'm giving you the basis. All you have to do is use the definition of the Heck operators on Q expansions, which is in the notes. B is finding the characteristic polynomial of a matrix, which is something you know from 21. Or we know from 21 from that class. I don't know. I think it's the linear algebra.
Oh, or 120F.
One of the 20s, yeah, 21F. Right. From TA and 21F, we're taking it. you might know how to compute the Carroll polyhedron matrix. And then the third problem is kind of a theoretical problem that asks you to think about precision that's needed in order to compute something. Problem 7 is to explicitly compute M2 gamma 0 of 5, the space of modular symbols. So in class, we completely worked out these steps, but for M2 gamma 0 of 2, and this is just M2 gamma 0 of 5. So it gives you a chance to think through carefully all the steps for that one. Then finally, in problem 8, you get to think about the algorithm I explained for computing bases of Q expansions using homomorphisms. And I've given you enough information explicitly to compute the first three terms of the Q expansions of a basis for this particular space, given what's indicated there. So the space being S2 gamma 0 of 23. So that's the final that's due on Friday at 5 p.m. a week from now. So that Friday. Okay, so today what we're going to do, I wanted to discuss the class projects for a little while to see how they're going. So, how are they going? Okay. Right, so why don't we just go around and you can say, like in 3 minutes or less, just summarize what you're doing to everyone.
Start on
that side. Okay, you're prepared.
I'm working on computing ACP for elliptic curves, so that's valuable for, so oftentimes to learn about the curves, you want to know something about the L function, and it turns out those ACP are like a step class, are just coded for the L function. And for computing those guys, there's an algorithm in Cohen's book that he talks about. There's a naive algorithm which involves the Legendre symbol, and just, you know, exhausting over the entire finite field, you know, for whatever P you're talking about. There's a smarter algorithm that involves the base of giant step, an even smarter algorithm beyond that, which also involves base of giant step algorithm, but tweaks it a little bit. So what I wanted to do was talk about that algorithm, just, you know, explain it in the paper, and then also, I'm not sure if this is feasible, but I wanted to try and talk about, do some examples with some small programs for doing this. By hand or showing up on the computer. Okay, that's what I'm going to talk about later. But then go through a couple examples of that. And then I was also thinking about looking at some source code of Curry and trying to see how it's actually implemented. But that seems to be the hardest part so far. Understand Curry.
Any comments from the rest of you? Does it make sense what he's doing at all?
Sounds intense.
I mean, really, it's just there is an algorithm in Cohen's book. You just read it and understand what's happening. And it's due to Mestre, I think.
I think so. Yeah.
Shanks and Mestre, because the base is giant. So.
So what are you doing?
Working on a primality testing problem. It's specifically using this algorithm made by these three Indian guys called the AKS algorithm, I guess, because of their name. And it's just basically reading the algorithm, trying to understand it. And I'm just stuck right now when I'm trying to implement this on Sage. Mm-hmm. It says that I've got to pick a natural number, and I'm just thinking if I should just pick, if it's got to be a specific natural number, it can be like, do I go through a list of natural numbers? So I'm just thinking about that.
So do you have to choose a random one in some range, in some interval? You can choose one at random in some interval. Maybe that's what you're supposed to do. Just choose two.
Okay.
I don't know. You probably have to choose a random integer in some interval, like between zero, you know, two and a billion or something like that. I don't know. You'll have to show me exactly where the problem is.
Probably.
Any questions about what he's doing? It's primality testing.
Is there any way you can explain just basically what the primality test is?
It's basically this algorithm in this paper they published and this other book that I'm looking at. I'm not exactly sure the exact steps off the top of my head, but...
So, you know, there's a primality test where if you take, say, 2 and raise it to the power of n minus 1, if n is prime, then you will get 1 by Fermat's little theorem. And if you don't get 1, it's definitely not prime. So you'd like to generalize this somehow, and a trick is to instead work modulo, work in a quotient of a polynomial or in modulo sum.
Just like
you work in an extension of FP, and not a field extension, a ring extension of FP. So it's like FP join X modulo something. So instead of doing the test with 2, you do the test in FP of X modulo something, and you have to choose your somethings very carefully. But if you do it modulo enough correct somethings, then you will be able to prove primality. And you can prove the number of things you have to do at modulo that somehow follow you in the input. So basically it's just like a naive generalization of the, you know, raise a number to a power test modulo something else, but using polynomials. And then the really clever part is proving that you've used enough polynomials to prove primality.
Basically
it's like a converse. No, it's totally deterministic. It's as if you raise this this element of this ring to a certain power and get, you know, 1 basically for enough rings and enough powers and so on, enough elements, then you definitely have a prime number. The converse of Fermat's little theorem. But you do it in polynomial rings. And amazingly, you can do it and prove that you only need a certain, you know, like a bounded number of polynomial rings.
Is that a recent result? Or?
Yeah. It's a huge theorem, or it's a simple theorem, but it's a very famous result. It was in the New York Times, for example. And it was published in the Annals of Math.
When?
Good journal. I don't know, I think it was, do you know when it was?
2002 is when.
Yeah,
oh, very
recent. Yeah, it's pretty recent. It was like the Holy Grail or something for a long time to give a deterministic just a deterministic primality test, but it doesn't in any way depend on random input. I mean, of course, you could give it some random input, maybe make it faster, but you can prove that in a completely deterministic way, it'll finish in polynomial time. Yeah.
That's the
So it just it stumped everyone for decades that these two graduate students and this professor in India were doing like a student project, and they figured it out. There were no problems with their original idea either, of course. And then the only thing is there were conferences after it in which various people. For example, my thesis advisor, Hunter Flintstrom, did a lot to refine the method to make it a little bit faster. And Dan Bernstein and others, but yeah, it's really nice. And the algorithm really isn't complicated to describe. Like, in the book you showed me, it was just the actual, you know, code is just a few lines. It's just a proof that the algorithm is right. That's more complicated. So, that's your project. What about, which was?
I'm writing a discussion about the security of different cryptosystems.
Huh? How's it going? Say more.
That's way too much to read. So I don't know where I'm good.
So what are your favorites to look at?
The RSA cryptosystem and then some elliptic cryptosystem. I'm trying to see. We already saw that elliptic curve is smart in some way. It should have smaller key sizes. But does it mean that it is more secure? That's what I'm trying to.
Right. Yeah.
So it's probably going to be something about factoring.
The frustrating thing is there are no theorems without any assumptions. So there's no theorem that factoring is hard in any sense at all. Factoring might be just ridiculously easy for all of us. Everything could be easy as far as, you know, related to cryptography. But I think people still prove theorems of the form. Assume some problem is hard, then this other problem is provably just as hard. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know. I think that's what you're going to have to look at for the sort of thing you're doing. Yeah, I have that plus heuristics, and just that, you know, you can look at what is the biggest RSA cryptosystem that's been broken by actual people, you think of cash prizes, and what's the biggest elliptic curve cryptosystem that's been broken by people when there are, you know, prizes or at least honor to be won. And then you can just see, you can compare the two and see what the difference is. But it's annoying because there's really very little in the way of theorems at present. You probably also want to mention that quantum computers can break anything.
Have that really does a small amount of
if they can be built. Which is a big question. I'm not too optimistic.
So the question is, how hard is it to build a quantum computer?
Yeah, it might be impossible, I don't know. You can build one that might be. The question is, how hard is it to build a really complicated quantum computer?
I guess it's just, it takes advantage of things that happen at, you know, subatomic level. I don't really know.
I mean, somehow you're encoding all possible computations all at once and then just choosing the right answer. I don't know.
Yeah, it's like you can take infinitely many states or something like that with a given orientator, some particle.
But there's some formula. There's a paper by Peter Shor, I think, who, when he wrote it, I think he worked at AT&T or Bell Labs or something. And he wrote this paper, maybe 10 pages, and he proves that if you can build a quantum computer, then you can factor integers quickly, and you can solve the discrete log problem in the integers modulo p, a multiplicative group of integers modulo p quickly. So you can do both of those problems.
And everything.
Yeah. Okay. So it doesn't break, you know, discrete log in a black box group, but it's completely generic group, I guess. Or maybe it does. I don't know, actually. I don't know whether it does or not. But I think at the beginning of his paper, he formulates what he means by a quantum computer so that he's able to, you know, prove a theorem. It's really a math paper. So he says, a quantum computer is blah. He gives a precise mathematical definition for his purposes. And then says, now given such an object, I will give you an algorithm that factors integers quickly, etc. So if you want to, if you ask a physicist what a quantum computer is, I'm sure you'll get a lot different answer than reading the beginning of this paper by Shor.
Okay.
So I guess that would tell you like what a quantum computer is in the same sense that a regular computer is a Turing machine, right?
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah. Precisely. Yeah. A Turing machine.
Just a mathematical abstraction of a digital computer. Just like a machine that takes different. If you read it, like, just Google it, you'll find it. Right now.
It's like this long tape that you can prove that you put symbols on, and you can read symbols off of it and write symbols back. And you can prove that anything you could, say, program on a normal computer, you could program on a Turing machine. So it's just some construction that's formally very useful in computer science. What do you think?
I think we can do the RSA challenge problems and discussion of it.
So it's similar to what Charles did.
Yeah.
You guys should talk to each other.
Yeah, I looked at the history of like what algorithms were used and the general number of fields used and seeing popular one.
Yeah,
but then doing exactly the new one and stuff.
Yeah.
Just looking at different, like the background that they've been doing and discussing the. I was going to discuss the actual algorithm, the motivation for it, how it came from the, was it polynomial soup? Was that the name of the one before it or something?
There's a quadratic sieve, cubic sieve.
Yeah, I think it was a quadratic sieve, but yeah. I read some paper that like nicely tied the two together, so it's kind of doing a little bit of summary of that.
There's a Springer lecture notes of big historic interest by Lundstrom. They're the editors. It's a bunch of articles, but it's a good place to look for historical background on the number fields of. Plus, it has a nice picture on the cover, which is supposed to illustrate the number fields of. Yeah, it's a hugely important argument. And it's also useful for solving discrete log problem.
Is the idea that you see like working in smaller pieces basically and then building it back up, or so like working modular bunch of primes?
Sort of. The idea is to find relations. Basically, you want to find an equation of form x squared is common root to y squared mod n. And then that's the same as x minus y times x plus y, 0 mod n. So if you take the GCD of x minus y with n, or x plus y with n, you might get a factor of n. So you try to find, that, I mean, that's not the general number of fields, but it's the quadratic. So you're basically trying to find a number, you're trying to find a solution to that equation. X squared is common root to y squared mod n. So,
and n is just n.
Yeah. So you can think of that as just x squared common root to 1 mod n, where x is a rational, well, where x is a... Well, it's just, I think it's just as good to find a solution to x squared congruent to 1 mod n. So if you could find a solution to that, you could have a chance of factoring in. You know, if x were 1, you don't. But if you find a non-trivial solution that's not minus 1, then you're pretty likely to factor in. You will factor in. So by taking the GCD of x minus 1, so you want to find a solution to this, and you can reduce it to a linear algebra problem. So what you do is you, let's see if I can, you find lots of, you just sieve through, you look for lots and lots of different numbers, and you factor them, and you look for numbers that are only divisible by a bunch of small primes, smooth numbers. We had smoothness before when we looked at the Bray's factoring algorithms, the Pollard p minus 1 method. So if you have a bunch of numbers that are smooth, you can think of them as elements of a free abelian group on some, you know, fixed collection of prime numbers. So at p, you say the prime numbers up to some bounds. So just some set of prime numbers, finite set of prime numbers. For a second. So this is the same as when you square the congruent to y squared mod n. Okay, so you want x squared to be 1 mod n. So that basically, you take a whole bunch. Each time you have a number that's just divisible by these small primes, you can look at the corresponding vector, which is the exponents, and you reduce it modulo 2 because you only care about things up to squares. So, basically, what you do is you find some linear combination of those vectors mod 2, which is the same as a product of those numbers with various coefficients that's, I think, equal to, well, the linear combination of the vectors is 0 mod 2, which is exactly the same as the product of the numbers being equal to 1 up to squares. So let's see where the mod n comes from exactly. I think you're really good for a solution to this. I don't remember exactly what it works at the moment. Yep. But it's really a matter of doing, you know, reducing the question of finding a solution to this equation to the question of doing a linear algebra problem in a space of vectors modulo 2. That's the idea of it. if I think about this for a minute longer, I'll probably just pop in a moment. In a minute, so I'll just pause. So essentially your project's evolving into a discussion of the number field sieve?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm looking at the different
numbers and
stuff.
Okay, that's good.
So I'll get that.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the exact description of how to do the linear algebra, but man. So, let's see. I think if you go to my website, you'll find a student project, or I can email you. You'll find a student project, I think, on the number field sieve, so you might want to look at that. I think, a senior thesis by John Grigg. So, I might find that interesting. Are you doing a project?
No.
Maybe you could say something about the research project, because that's actually extremely relevant to the course. That's your project.
Verifying the origin and swing generic conjecture for CM Lebesgue curves with rank 0 and 1 for conductor.
Well, that over 0 and 1?
Well, with rank 0 or 1.
Okay.
Because for rank 0 and 1, it's known for the rank part, the order of the vanishing of the L series of 0, it's known to be the rank. Rank 0 or 1. So I'm just doing the other part, the actual, and the L series, the order of vanishing at 0, it's actually kind of what it's supposed to be, orders of shot, and things like that. So I'm trying to do that for a lot of CM curves.
So the result is known right now, or you're trying to...
So the rank part? No, there's the two parts.
There's
the part that, well, the rank is just the order of vanishing at 0, and that's known for when the rank is 0 or 1.
And the analytic rank is 0 or 1.
Yeah, when it's supposed to be 0 or 1, right, everything matches up. And then there's that thing that says that when you take the order of vanishing at 0,
I'll illustrate what you're saying.
The order of Shaw times the regulator, and there's some common error. There's two parts to it. It's easier to read than it's said.
So he's verifying this part. So.
Crazy group on
the... Yeah, the Shafir-Rich T group. Essentially what he's doing is he's computing this group. And I guess he's starting with Kermode's book, and in there are, I think, 54? Or 40-something? 44 CM elliptic curves up to isogeny. And for each one, the BSD conjecture asserts that this group has order 1. So you have to compute this group in each case, see that it really does have order 1. But this group is quite difficult to compute. So fortunately, there are lots of theorems about it. So you put them all together and hopefully combine them with some verification of hypotheses and get that the order really is 1.
Is that isogeny just means like the group is isomorphic?
Wait, sorry.
What does isogeny mean?
Just
means the group.
An isogeny between elliptic curves is a homomorphism of finite degree. And it's a homomorphism of finite degree over Q. It's a very, very hard thing to have. It's extremely rare that two elliptic curves will be isogenous. In fact, if you have an elliptic curve over Q, there's at most seven other curves that are isogenous to it. It's very, very limiting. Up to isomorphism, but yeah. But the maximum size of an isogeny class is 8.
That's weird.
Yeah. Actually, I don't know if that fact has been completely written down, but it's fairly easy to obtain from things in the literature, according to various people. It's just occasionally you have homomorphisms from a curve to something else. That's what an isogeny is. Surjective homomorphism. Very, very strong thing. For example, if two curves are isogenous, the AP are the same. Exactly the same. Relevant to your project. So, And conversely, if all the API are the same, it's a theorem that the curves are isogenous. It's a much deeper fact. Pretty amazing, actually, that if you have two curves that a priori have nothing to do with them, and when you reduce them modulo, primes always have the same number of points, then the curves are actually isogenous. They're almost isomorphic. There's some homomorphism of finite degree between them. I told you about Mordell's conjecture earlier in this course, and he essentially what he really proved was the statement I just made about the converse, except for abelian varieties instead of elliptic curves, that if the point counts are the same, then the abelian varieties are isogenous. And that was really the key input, the key difficult thing that he proved in order to prove, in order to bound the number of, or in order to show that there are only finitely many points on a curve of genus 2 or greater over a number field, over any number field. So strangely enough, this fact about point counting implying that elliptic curves are isogenous is related to this question of Mordell.
And why? Is there some reason that the class is going to be of at most 8?
It's very difficult to have an isogeny. And in fact, this curve x0 of n, which I've talked about a lot, and which of course came up a lot in talking about modular forms. So this is the curve that I defined as take gamma 0 of n, acting on the upper half plane, and you take the orbits, has genus roughly n over 12. So this is a Riemann surface, but in fact, this is the set of complex points of a curve that's defined over Q. And its points correspond to isomorphism classes of elliptic curves with an isogeny of degree n. And it's just a curve. Its genus gets very large very quickly, and by Faulting's theorem, there's only finitely many points on this thing. For n greater than or equal to, or some bound, but after when n gets bigger than I think 160, there's some bound on n, so that for all larger n, this has genus 2 or greater, so it has only finitely many points. Therefore, there can be, for n bigger than that bound, there can be only finitely many pairs of elliptic curves that have an isogeny of degree n. So if your curve had hundreds and hundreds of other curves isogenous to it, there would have to be hundreds and hundreds of different isogeny degrees. But after a while, there's a very limited number of possibilities for the degree of an isogeny. Just because after a while, whenever you have an isogeny of degree n, you have a point on this, and this doesn't have very many points on it. In fact, Maser proved that for sufficiently large n, there are no points at all, except for that correspond to elliptic curves. There's the cusp, there's nothing else that's rational. So basically, the reason that there are very few isogenies between elliptic curves over Q is because there are very few points on the modular curve x0 of n over the field Q. Likewise, Morel, Loic Morel, proved uniform boundedness for elliptic curves over number fields, and that was again obtained by proving something about rational points on this curve, but over number fields. And I won't say too much more, but if you want to understand isogenies between elliptic curves, the thing to understand is this curve itself, or its points over number fields. I define this as it's an object that parametrizes pairs an elliptic curve in a cyclic subgroup of order n. But if you have an elliptic curve in a cyclic subgroup of order n and it's all defined over Q, then you get an isogeny, which is E maps to E modulo that cyclic subgroup. If the group's defined over Q, then this isogeny is also defined over Q, and this will be an elliptic curve also defined over Q. By C being defined over Q, I mean that if you have any element of C and you take its image via an automorphism of Galois of Q bar, and you get another element of C. I think it was initially a big mystery why there are so few isogenies, but it was really resolved by what Maser did in understanding the rational points on x0 of n. So any more questions about what Aaron's project's on? So it's on computational verification that this group is one in a large number of examples. And you should actually search through the tables and find out. We should also look at some cases where this has order that's not even one. That would be funner. There's a thesis of Janet Chen, right? And I think she has lots of examples where it's non-trivial, so you can look there. And if you don't know what a CM elliptic curve is, an example is the Clongard number curve. This is a CM elliptic curve. There are others, but it's one particular family. There are 13 elliptic curves over Q, so that every CM elliptic curve is isomorphic to one of those over Q bar. So somehow those 13 are really important. For example, this one is isomorphic to y squared equals x cubed minus x over Q bar. If you're allowed to take square roots, you can find a change of variables to go from here to here. Okay, so that's Aaron's project. And what about your project? What's your name again?
Sorry.
Kevin. What are you doing your project on?
The computation of Bernoulli numbers.
Okay, can you explain it to everyone here?
Explain it to everyone?
Yeah, what's the idea?
So, let's see. Should I say what Bernoulli, numbers are, or just?
No. It's not like a formal presentation of your project. We're just trying to get feedback from everyone.
So originally I was looking at the parity code that suggested to try and figure out how it is so fast.
Right.
And they were using some sort of an analytic technique as opposed to there's like a normal recurrence where you just build up Bernoulli numbers and you just pick one of your combinations of the one before and then you get the next one. And it's sort of order n squared. So to do it faster, they're evaluating this data. So Euler evaluated say that it positive even integers in terms of Bernoulli numbers, so you can find some expression for Bernoulli number.
We have that in the notes for class or in class because I read it up in the notes. So zeta of k is something involving a Bernoulli number.
So you want to approximate zeta, but we're trying to find the Bernoulli number as a fraction, not as a real number. So how in general. It's not sufficient just to approximate, give it a decimal approximation, but there's a theorem that tells you precisely what the denominator of any Bernoulli number will be, not having to know the previous Bernoulli numbers, just in terms of prime divisors of n, I guess.
And the theorem's very simple. You told me about it last time. It's just the product of p minus 1.
Yeah. You take your number n and you look at for if p minus 1 divides n, then that prime occurs in the denominator of the root.
So it's a product of your primes p such that p minus 1 divides n.
Yeah. And so you just, if you find all the divisors of your n, you just then add 1 to each of them and see if they're prime. So you have the dividers, you add one to them all, is prime, and then the ones that are, you just multiply them together. Mm-hmm. So then you have to figure out how close you need to approximate zeta so that when you clear by the denominator, you're close enough to the numerator. If you take like a ceiling.
Uh-huh. And you looked in the Perry code and decided they're computing zeta using the Euler product representation?
Yeah, using Euler product, so.
So that's just me. So zeta is sum 1 over n to the s, but that's also equal to the product of the prime numbers of 1 over 1 minus p to the minus s. So you just take some truncated version of that product, and you just substitute the value of s that you want to compute that, and it converges very, very quickly.
Yeah, because if n is very large, you just look at the expression.
Or s, if the s that you're plugging in.
Yes, or s, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and so you get this very rapidly converging thing. It's converging to the value of zeta that you want to compute. So in Perry, they don't say anything about why they've computed enough terms, or
No, the only comments in the code are just compute zeta using Euler product, then there's some comment that has that formula, you know, for Zeta in terms of the real number. But I think one of the things is actually the wrong part of the fraction. Like, it's commented wrong, but the code does the right thing, apparently. The right numbers don't have.
So it would be nice to make it an improved version where it proves, you know, explains why, what precision is really needed. Did you make any progress on that? Coming up with a provably correct bound on the number of factors in the product that you need?
Yeah, so I can do that, but then on how close I need to approximate data. Yeah. But then in the Perry, there's two things that are sort of like, one thing is how close to compute it, and the other thing I think is the precision to use for the arithmetic.
That's right.
It's not clear to me what the precision to the arithmetic needs to be. So modulo the numerical analysis, I understand everything.
Oh, excellent. Any comments or questions from other people about this? So, we now understand at least basically how to compute really that moves faster than the authors of Magma and so on. Okay, so.
Just have a general question for a piece of software like Magma. If they find themselves in a situation where an open source algorithm is faster than theirs, why don't they just wrap up the one that's faster and use that in the newest version of their software?
I know you're
doing. Okay.
But they have to recode it or copy the code out somehow. They can't just take the code literally off because the code depends on other libraries. Like,
right.
I look at the Perry code and try to paste that into.
Yeah, it shouldn't be.
They do. It's just it's just a matter of effort. In fact, like, you have to train somebody to be able to use the Magma C library, you know, program stuff in Magma C, which is, and that only will happen for people that, you know, go down and visit the Magma group. So there's really, I mean, if you coded the algorithm you're describing in the Magma interpreter, it wouldn't be very fast. It might not be much faster it might not be very fast just because you're using the interpreter, which is maybe, you know, 5 to 100 times slower than coding something in a compiled language. So, it's just purely a matter of effort. Maybe I'll do it, I don't know, in this particular case, or at least I'll get somebody to do it. That's what happened with computing ASAP and Magma. Until about a year ago, it was incredibly slow. And the guy who initially wrote it wouldn't do the work to change it, didn't really know what to do exactly to fix it. So it just sort of sat there. And I recommended Mark Watkins go down there and fix it. And they hired him for a year, and that was one of the main things he spent his time on. He looked at what Perry did, then he tried to recode it in Magma, and then ended up being very frustrated by how slow floating point arithmetic was in Magma. So we got them to include MPFR, which is LGPL. It's a GPL program, but you can use it in non-GPL software. So you got them to include MPFR, and then using, I think that wasn't enough either. So then there's something called quad double that I think he ended up using extensively. I mean, it's surprising that floating point numbers have anything to do with this. I may be confusing. He coded several different things. One of them was, they all involve computing the ASAP or things that you can compute from the ASAP. So in any case, he went down there and he coded what Perry did into Magma. And now Magma's computation of AP is about the same speed as Perry's. And he claimed that he discovered some bugs in Perry's implementation and told the Perry people about it so they could fix it. So sort of good in both directions. But at the end of the day, it's just a matter of effort.
Okay.
Yep. Okay, other questions or comments? Yes?
Sure, can I ask a quick question for a moment?
Yeah.
Question about Perry. So
yeah.
I was kind of wondering why it would compute that Zeta with the other product as opposed to the sum, because 1 over Zeta, you know, 1 over, what is it, you know, n to the s also gets.
I think that.
I mean, it converges very rapidly.
I think when you use the sum, you're truncating, you know. So, just so that everyone understands, we're talking about.
I was wondering if it was maybe because we already have a list of primes.
It does.
Available to it.
Yes.
So
it does.
If that wasn't the case, then.
It's very easy to make a big list of primes, though.
Oh, okay.
Very, very fast. So this is the Riemann zeta function, the famous Riemann zeta function, which has the amazing property that if you analytically continue it, the zeros should all lie at, except for the trivial zeros along the negative axis, should all lie at unreal part of s equal to a half. Of course, that's the Riemann hypothesis. But in any case, zeta of, I should write down what it is exactly. I can't remember off the top of my head. Is it something like zeta of k is, do you remember?
Zeta, I would say zeta of 2k or something.
Yeah, okay.
It's going to be 2 pi to the k, and there's going to be,
you've got to be there somewhere.
It won't be on the bottom, though, I don't think. E to the 2k, because it won't be an odd number on the right.
Yeah. So just that?
No, there's more, I just, that's
for k to the integer.
Yes, this is for k integer, positive integer.
Yeah.
Is that it? No.
Let's say 2k factorial.
So
you get 180 factorial.
Here?
Yeah, it's just a question of whether the pi's and the factorials, you know, maybe they should be interchanged.
Okay, so put a question mark here. But something
yeah,
like this.
Like, yeah.
It's something like this, and I don't remember what it is exactly. But in order to compute this, you can equivalently compute this and this stuff. Whatever this stuff is, it's easy to compute to arbitrarily high precision. So the question is to compute this to high precision. And you have this, but just by the fact that every integer has a unique prime factorization, this is equal to the product of 1 over 1 minus p to the minus s, like that. And the product is over all prime numbers. So the fact that you have equality here is essentially equivalent to the statement that we have prime factorization uniquely. And the fact that this diverges when you substitute s equal to 1 in is equivalent to the statement that there are infinitely many primes. One of Euler's proofs of infinitude in the set of prime numbers. So, it's a real proof. So you want to evaluate this, and you have, from this, you have two choices. See, it's really nice because this 2k is some large real positive integer, so this series actually converges, which is a good sort of bonus. You can plug into either one and then truncate your evaluation. So instead of considering that sum, you can consider a sum like this, or you could consider a product of your prime p less than equal to some bound real complex. Also notice that when you substitute in s equal to 2k, so that's what you're trying to compute in both cases, the volume at 2k, here you're just adding up smaller and smaller positive numbers as you compute more and more terms of the series and add them up. So this is the limit of strictly increasing sequence of positive real numbers, where it's, you know, getting bigger more slowly. So when you truncate this, you don't have any sort of worries about it going sort of up and down or oscillating like crazy because of the tail. It's just going to get a little bit bigger if you include the rest of the sum. So I think that the reason to use the product instead of the sum is that when you use the product up to x, if you expand this out, what you get is, it's like this sum where you're taking all n that are divisible only by the primes up to x, but you're getting infinitely many different n. It's just any n that's divisible by those primes. Whereas here you're just getting the integers up to x. So you really get a much, much better sum here because it's like this sum, but you get a bunch of other stuff that's also included for free,
yeah,
so to speak.
Makes sense.
Plus it's really even better because you're just taking a product of the primes, and there are a lot less primes up to x than there are integers up to x. So really this should be much, much better. You're simply summing over a bigger set of integers. It's the same as summing a sum like this, but over a bigger set of integers. That's just going to get you closer to the true value of zeta.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
Any questions or comments?
I use the thing on the left to get my error bound.
Just because it's easy, yeah.
So then, because it's easy.
There might be a better error bound.
I need a better to really take advantage of what you said. I need an error bound on that.
That's right. it would be nice to have an Erbat on the right. I just don't know how to do the Delta. Or you didn't know how to do it last time. So any comments, questions about anything related to the projects? So again, they're going to be due at the same time as the final on Friday next week. And I'd like you to turn in a very rough draft on Wednesday, which is the day after tomorrow. So write up something. Don't worry about it being perfect at all. The main point of writing it up is to get additional feedback from me. And I think you all have something in your head now that you can just dump on the paper. Okay? But don't be a perfectionist at all at this point. Okay, so... the rest of my list has review of Dirichlet characters, conductors, and then writing down all Eisenstein series. And it's actually pretty easy, this writing down all Eisenstein series thing. Really just set the context of what we'll talk about. So the general structure of the course has been, well, first we started with elliptic curves over Q, and there's a big theorem which says that elliptic curves over Q are all attached to modular forms. So given an elliptic curve over Q, there's a corresponding modular form, sub a n Q to the n, n equals 1 to infinity, where a sub p is p plus 1 minus the number of points on the elliptic curve over fp. And this is an element of S2 gamma 0 of n, where n is the conductor of the elliptic curve, which is an integer divisible by primes of bad reduction that somehow measures the badness of the reduction. And so you wonder about this space. What else is in here besides the modular forms coming from elliptic curves? I'd like to compute it. And it's actually a subspace of a slightly bigger space, M2 gamma 0 of n. And these spaces, M2 gamma 0 of n, are special cases of spaces MK gamma 0 of n, modular forms of weight k and level n. And more generally, these are contained in slightly bigger spaces, mk, gamma 1 of n. So for each integer k greater than or equal to 1, and each integer n greater than or equal to 1, you have a finite dimensional complex vector space of modular forms of weight k and level n. And these modular forms attached to elliptic curves live inside of these spaces. And there's a lot of sort of really neat, subtle information about elliptic curves that can only really be understood properly when you understand elliptic curves in the context of these more general, or at least modular forms attached to elliptic curves, in the context of these more general spaces. But there's also sort of a huge motivating trend in number theory or arithmetic geometry that can be understood, at least in a certain special case, best in terms of these spaces. I'm alluding to the Langlands program, which is some like deep correspondence between Galois representations and automorphic forms. These spaces of modular forms are closely related to automorphic forms. Automorphic forms are somehow a big generalization of modular forms. The special case of Langlands in the context of modular forms, at least one special case of it, is something called Serre's conjecture, which says that any representation rho from any homomorphism from Galois Q-bar over Q to the automorphisms of a two-dimensional vector space. I'll make people simpler. So any homomorphism from here to GL to FP, so FP bar with a finite image, and should be continuous, meaning that the kernel is the subgroup of elements of the Galois group that fix some number field. So if you have such a homomorphism, it should arise from a modular form in a certain very precise sense. Any homomorphism at all like this has the property that, well, there's a sequence of numbers you can attach to a row called the traces of Frobenius. there's certain algebraic numbers. And you have coefficients of your modular form. There are also these numbers, and they should match up. Given any representation like this, these A sub P should match up with the A sub P of a modular form. That's called Serre's conjecture. It's a very difficult question. Serre won the Abel Prize recently, which is, I think he was the first winner of the Abel Prize. It's like the Nobel Prize, but for mathematicians. And he's interviewed in me after winning the prize, and the interviewer has asked him what the most difficult piece of mathematics he ever did was. And it was making this conjecture that any representation like this comes from a modular form, in the sense that somehow arithmetic data that you can write down in terms of the representation matches up with the coefficients of the modular form. So generally, it's a similar notion to the modularity of elliptic curves, but for representations. So he said that after he did this, he was so exhausted that he didn't do any real math for 2 years. And that's Serre. So it's an important conjecture. And in fact, it's almost a theorem. It's probably the most active area of current research in number theories, trying to polish off the details of proving this. It's been proved in a huge number of important cases. So the only reason I'm telling you that is just to motivate you to have some interest in spaces MK, gamma, 1 of n. They're not just, you know, these ridiculous spaces I'm randomly cooking up for the course. They're really, really central in number theory. Okay, so how do you
think? Is that called the total Galois group, or what do you call that group?
I call it Gal cube over cube.
Okay.
Or the absolute Galois group of cube.
Okay, because I've heard people say that, and I was just wondering if that's what that was.
Yeah. I don't know what the total Galois group is. I call it the absolute Galois group.
Maybe that's what I heard.
Yeah. In order to avoid lying, since I was so precise about what this means, there's one other condition, which is, well, complex conjugation defines an element of the Galois group. And the other condition is that if you take the image of complex conjugation, you have to get a matrix of determinant minus 1. It's crucial. If you don't have that, then Serre doesn't make any conjecture about your representation coming from a modular form. So this should be rho of complex conjugation supposed to be a determinant minus 1. But it just looks like a ridiculous technical condition to you. But it's important. So I talked a lot about how to compute this when n equals 1. You just write down e4 and e6 and take products and multiply them together. And if you do that enough, you'll get this space for n equals 1. And there was a nice basis, which I called the Victor-Miller basis for the level 1 forms. I also described in complete detail how to compute S2 gamma 0 then. You write down the elements of P1 of Z mod NZ. So you write down pairs CD up to Z mod NZ star equivalents. Those are the Mannine symbols. And then you question out by the two-term and three-term relations. And you get some quotient space. And then you compute the action of Hecke operators on that quotient space. You compute T2, T3, T4, and so on. So you write down a bunch of matrices of Hecke operators on, et cetera, acting on I use the notation S2 gamma 0 n for the space of Mannine symbols modulo the two-term and three-term relations. Symbol CD. I don't know what notation to use, so just the Mannine symbols, modulo the two-term and three-term relations. And then, as I explained about a week ago, if you take any linear functional on these. So on this family of matrices, you can write down associated to it a Q expansion. So for example, if you take the top left entry of every one of these matrices, you stick those in a power series, and you've written down a modular form, a cuspidal modular form. And you do that with, say, the top right entry, or whatever, you choose any entry you want, and then just read those off, and that gives you the Q expansion of a modular form. And that's it. That gives you a basis. So, because there's a duality between, there's a perfect pairing between the Hecke operators and the space of cuss forms. So you know how to compute that space. You actually also know how to compute SK one of n, except that it's identical to what I told you. The only difference is that if you replace gamma 0 of n by gamma 1 of n, then instead of the cosets, instead of computing with the cosets of gamma 0 of n in SL2z, which were in bijection with the elements of P1 of z mod nz, you have to compute with the cosets of gamma 1 of n in SL2z, which is almost the same. Instead, you compute with pair CD, and the relation, I think, is just, there's a relation. So you take all pairs CD with 0 less than or equal to CD less than n, some condition GCD of C and D, and n is equal to 1. And there's a relation, but it's a lot weaker than before. I think it's just CD. It's slightly more subtle because it depends on whether the weight is even or odd. So, and the weights, I think it's minus C minus D equals minus 1 to the K CD. So there's a relation again. This is for gamma 1 of n. And then when you have a weight, you have to consider symbols x to the I, y to the k minus I, sorry, k minus 2 minus I CD. So it's, there's a polynomial part and then a symbol. And again, you get an action of GL2 on these symbols, just like before, and or SL2 on these symbols, just like before, except slightly more complicated. But you have two-term and three-term relations, you have Mannian symbols, you quotient out, and you get an explicit presentation for modular symbols of weight k or gamma 1 of n. Then you write down Hecke operators using exactly the same formulas as before, and linear functionals on the Hecke operators give you a basis for SK gamma 1 of n. So there's some work there, but the algorithm I described for computing S2 gamma 0 of n has a very natural generalization to SK gamma 1 of n, to modular symbols of weight k for the group gamma 1 of n. So that deals with the Hospital subspace. Now what about all of MK gamma 1 of n, or MK gamma 0 of n for that matter? So fortunately, you have a decomposition of MK, whichever MK we're talking about over here, as a direct sum of the Hospital subspace and an Eisenstein subspace. So MK gamma 1 of n is a direct sum of SK gamma 1 of n and the Eisenstein and the subspace of Eisenstein series of weight k for gamma 1 of n. So to compute the whole thing amounts to computing SK, which I'll just say is done now, and computing the subspace of standby Eisenstein series. So so how do you compute this subspace? Well, it's actually really easy in the case when you just care about gamma 0 of n. So for this one, it's really, really easy. Basically, all you do is you take, if k is greater than or equal to 4, you just take various images of E4. So or E6 or whatever, you know, Eisenstein series you have from level 1. So let's say that. There's a little bit of subtlety, but to compute, so I'll just say this one's easy. Gamma 0 of n. This is a subspace of nk gamma 0 of n, and it's basically just spanned by an image of E sub k of level 1. So this was E sub k, which was some constant term plus sub sigma sub k minus 1 of n q to the n. N equals 1 to infinity. So this was this is in MK SL2Z. shows the images of this. So by that I mean you take EK of Q and EK of Q, that's what it is, EK of Q to the T, where T varies through the divisors of N. So this gives you the Eisenstein subspace of MK gamma 0 of N, except in one case. When k equals 2, this doesn't work, because when k equals 2, this is not a modular form at all. So when k equals 2, you have to slightly modify the recipe. And in this, I describe sort of the ultimate generalization of the modification. But right, so it's just sort of pretty simple. So this is for k greater than or equal to 4. And then k equals 2, you take E2, defined exactly as before, but here's what you do. You take E2 of q minus t, E2 of q to the t. And you do this, you take the set of these for t dividing n. And of course, when t equals 1, this is just 0, so you don't get anything from that. And taking this difference exactly cancels out the the non-modular behavior of E2. This E2, to use this formula, it's not a modular form. It's holomorphic, but it doesn't have the modularity property. But the failure of the modularity property exactly gets canceled out when you take this linear combination. So that completely answers the question of how to compute a basis for MK gamma 0 of N. For MK gamma 1 of N, you have to work a little bit harder. You have to write down the Eisenstein series for gamma 1 of n. And the recipe involves Dirichlet characters. And that's what's described in section 5.2 of the notes, and more generally in chapter 5. So there's a completely explicit formula which generalizes the definition of EK given right there. And here's what it is. So, given a weight k, a Dirichlet character chi, a Dirichlet character psi, and a Dirichlet character psi, I'm going to write down a formal power series, similar to what I wrote down here, and it is a modular form. So here's what the power series is. There's a constant term, which I'll explain in a second, and then there's a big sum of big sums. So it's a sum over n greater than or equal to 1 of the sum over the divisors n of m of psi of n times pi of m divided by n, the divisor, so it's an integer, times n to the k minus n. So if chi and psi were the trivial character mod 1, then you're just this is just sigma sub k minus 1. It's like a twisted version of sigma k minus 1. Instead of taking the usual sum of the k minus first powers of the divisors, we're putting a coefficient in coming from the value of a character. So that's that. And then take the sum and then multiply by q to the m. And here c0 is, there are two possibilities. Either 0 or minus bk psi over 2k. So now I have to tell you what psi and chi are. I'm going to tell you which one we have here. Actually, I guess it's really pretty simple. It's the bottom one in the case when chi is the trivial character. And it's 0 when chi is not trivial. So the fact about this power series I wrote down is it's an element of MK gamma 1 of L times M, where L is the conductor of chi. I have to define that. And M is the conductor of psi.
And what's bk psi?
This is a generalized Bernoulli number. So when psi is a trivial character, it's just the usual Bernoulli number, b sub k. In general, you have to define Bernoulli numbers associated with characters. And if you look on page 69, there's a formula, and it's just sum a plus 1 to n minus 1. This is for a Dirichlet character, epsilon velvet for psi. So psi of a x e to the a x over e to the n x minus 1. So it's a Dirichlet character mod n. So I guess I'll call it L now, because psi is a character mod L. E to the Lx minus 1, and that's sum bk psi x to the k over k factorial. And I desperately wish I knew a fast way to compute these. The fact that I can't compute them quickly slows everything down in my programs. Well, not everything, but it slows some things down a lot. See, this is just a formal an identity of two power series, which defines the b sub k psi. When you have two Dirichlet characters, then you get this formal power series, and it defines a modular form. And if you run through all the possibilities, and also take images, so take ek chi psi q to the t, appropriately, you get a basis for the Eisenstein subspace. And that's how you do it. That's how you compute everything. So it's as simple as enumerating, running through the possibilities of chi and psi, so that the product of the conductors of these are L and M. The conductor of a Dirichlet character is the smallest integer such that the character factors through Z mod that integer. That's all. So it's not really a very complicated thing. So, for example, if you have a character modulo N, but it's induced by the identity map from Z mod NZ star, I mean, it's induced by the map that sends everything to 1, it actually factors through Z mod 1 Z star. So that's conductor 1. It's the smallest modulus that the character comes from. So I think I'm not going to go into much more detail. I think I'll stop at that, having explained now how to compute the Eisenstein subspace. Since I did it so quickly just to emphasize that it's not that complicated. You just get it by explicitly writing down pairs of characters and weights and writing down series. Just a generalization of what you do here. Just a completely explicit formula like this. So I think, is there anything else to say? How long do these things take? I think that we don't have enough time for this, but how long do these things take usually? Okay. There weren't any directions, but do you mind doing this right now? Okay, great. So I think I should get a volunteer to take them somewhere. How does this work here? I don't think we can see how this works. I'm sure some of you have done it before. Yeah.
Oh, maybe
I've done this, but I haven't already turned in.
You did this.
What is this one? 60.
Probably turn it in the front desk on the side.
Yeah,
that's
awesome.
Okay.
Can you do that with 10?
I don't. There's no way they're not instructions. But let me get out of here so that I can't see any numbers right now. Could somebody volunteer to take them to the main office if you're going back to the main office? Okay.